You're listening to The Last Exit Show with Caleb Horton and James Murphy.
When I get out, I'll be 49.
Why do you have to go, you know, to prison?
There was a misunderstanding.
A misunderstanding?
Yeah, me and another man. We misunderstood some things about the world, about how to be.
Who's the other man?
You'll laugh.
I'd never laugh at you. Not when you're like this.
Well, I suppose his name was Ricky Gervais, I guess. We misunderstood a couple of things, and then I'll be out when I'm 49.
Caleb, I'm not familiar with the American penal system, but I've never ever heard of a 23-year sentence for a misunderstanding anything.
Well, that's all it was. The world spins around and around the way it does. That's the way it was. It doesn't stop for one man.
Tell me what happened. Quit dancing, man.
I thought my way about how to be, and Mr. Gervais, he thought another way about how to be.
All right, I'm pulling up the court transcript.
Nah, don't do that. Let the past stay in the past. That's what my grandpa used to say. There's one thing I've tried to teach you. It's that we got to keep moving forward. You can't look back. You'll burn your eyes and you'll die from looking backwards, and it'll take your whole life to get there, and you'll be alone, James Murphy.
Mate, you only pull this salt of the earth bullshit when you're covering up some huge lie, you know? I know it's your tell, so you can't even get through a game of poker without telling me about some dead bluesman.
When was the last time you ran dirt through your hands? When was the last time you planted a crop with those hands? If you're not planting something, the seasons leave you behind. I don't care if it's wheat or if it's cotton or if it's flowers or...
Okay, it says here that you drove down to LA, you cornered Ricky Gervais at the Beverly Hilton, and it says attempted murder.
A crop doesn't just tell you the seasons, it makes you feel the seasons.
Oh, and here's a quote from you, a direct quote. It says, I'll kill him, don't treat me like a dog. Dogs aren't capable of murder, but I am. I'll kill him like a dog. He's a dog. I'm killing him.
Nah, you know, my grandpa, he picked cotton. I ever tell you about my grandpa's days picking cotton in the Dust Bowl?
Says here you put your thumbs in his eye. That's stupid. That wouldn't kill him, man.
Might have blinded him, though.
Yeah, maybe. But good, you're admitting it.
I mean, the sun might have blinded my dog, Sheba. It was so bright, the sun, and Sheba's eyes are very sensitive, I've learned.
Quote, yes, sir, he will die, unquote, you continue. So you started pulling his hair like a child. You said, yes, sir, he will die from this violent action I'm doing right now.
Misunderstanding all that was.
Says you're extremely intoxicated and had stolen a bottle of wine. Said you were pouring it all over yourself and then you poured it all over him and you said that he was laughing at first.
My dog's getting up there in years these days. She ain't doing too good. Hips are giving out, you know.
It says here that he stopped laughing then. Why did he stop laughing?
I don't know. The misunderstanding escalated. What do you want from me?
All right. Well, it says that you acquired a kitchen knife and you stabbed him brutally. Oh, okay. That's where the 23-year figures come from.
I don't usually worry about justice, you know. Only the Lord's justice. That's the only kind of justice there is.
It says, eyewitnesses confirm that after you stabbed him, you immediately started yelling, this is a misunderstanding. The liars are coming. This is a misunderstanding. Yeah, this all sounds like you, man.
Nah.
Okay, blah, 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 legal nonsense. Ricky Gervais is recovering nicely. Oh, Ricky Gervais is recovering nicely. That's excellent news. You know, if you killed him, that sentence would have been longer.
I tried to poison him, too.
Yeah, I know. Tried to force feed him a can of WD-40. That's stupid.
I was a desperate man in the middle of a misunderstanding. Cut me some slack. But hey, I gotta go. They say my time is up, and I'll be out when I'm 49. Visit me, won't you?
Nah.
Call me then.
Yeah, I got a number or whatever here. The number of the prison, I guess.
Don't forget me now. Don't forget me.
Caleb, wake up.
Leave me alone. I mean, what?
You're having that dream again. The one where you try to poison Ricky Gervais and you go to jail for 23 years.
Oh shit, I love that dream.
Yeah, I know you do, but we gotta record this podcast before I pass out.
Whatever.
There was a
So, how are you?
I'm doing all right, considering all the terrible things that are constantly happening to me.
I don't consider those things.
Well, you know, whether you do or don't consider them, my week has been going A-okay.
Cool. So, you know, I moved down to this place. It's my new home. And I like it because it's quiet, but it's quite close to insane underclass actions all the time. I spoke about it last episode. Mm. And the most recent, or at least the most severe manifestation of extreme underclass action was the taking over of a disused post office and abandoned, post office, it's a sorting centre. And a bunch of kids who like drum and bass and dance music and house music decided to turn up to this place 10 minutes down the road from me, if that, as a walk. And they proceeded to dance and take drugs and listen to music that I could only ever identify with if I took enough drugs to kill me. And
hold on, were they squatting, or was this one of those legal things where they had some boho benefactor?
No, this was completely illegal. This was an illegal
fantastic
rave.
That's great.
Yeah, they turned up to this party, and the venue for the rave, this disused Royal Mail sorting office, could only take about 100 people, but many thousands of children turned up with drugs and alcohol.
Violates all kinds of fire codes and stuff, man. They shouldn't be doing that.
That was my first concern, too. But one person died, which isn't fun. We won't dwell on that. But the thing that really caught my eye about this evil rave, and I find it a very creepy trope, the evil rave, you know, people very thin and dancing in the dark and it smells bad.
Well, you always imagine there's some secret drug that you've never heard about that is invented at one of those raves and distributed there.
It just makes them evil and their eyelids go black. So anyway, there's this one kid, I think he was about 16 years old.
Why would anyone do a drug that just makes you evil? That's a worthless drug. That's no fun.
No, I can't.
There's plenty of great drugs that are really cheap.
Yeah, that have practical applications, like keeping you awake whilst you're trying to, I don't know, write to a deadline. But this evil drug must have been circulating here. But this small boy, he heard the fire alarm going off and the peer pressure of the thousands of ravers in this empty post office shouting, "Tear it off, tear it off, tear it off." So this child clambers up the wall and he tries to pull the alarm off the wall, the giant industrial sized alarm. And he loses a finger immediately. And I think the kid must have gone into some sort of shock, because immediately in his head, he resolved it in such a way where he's like, well, I might have lost a finger, but I should definitely keep dancing. To quote the headline to this article that I've brought up to support my feelings here, "I lost my finger at the East Croydon rave." And there's some stuff about how he got to the party, how the police were surrounding it, how there some fights with the police as the music blasted evenly. Let me just scroll down as we speak to you to the incisive point.
And this sounds like the kind of article Vice would write.
This is a Vice article. It's next to some stuff about a beauty pub to watch the World Cup and clean British engineers and all that sort of nonsense. But here we come down to what the interviewer, the journalist, has to say to this boy, Josh. "So what happened with your finger, Josh?" "Well, about 1 a.m. and sit tight, listeners, because I'm going to quote a big extract out of this interview. Caleb can interject all he wants. "About 1 a.m, we're in the house room, but I don't really like
Don't
house.
Worry, I'm not going to interject shit. I'm drinking this coffee.
"So I was waiting for the drum and bass to kick in. As soon as I heard it, me and my mate went down there. 5 minutes in, the alarm goes off, and everyone's like, rip it off, rip it off, as I told the listeners. So I thought I'd give it a go, and I tried to pull it down. I was completely sober at the time. I jumped up, grabbed it, and my little finger got caught in the case because it was all broken. As I came to rip it back down, my little finger got ripped off completely." The journalist asks, "Jesus, what did you do next?" And this child goes on, "I looked at my hand, and my little finger was gone. The bone was sticking out. It's the weirdest feeling. One second you're fine, and your little finger is there, and the next second it's gone. It shoves reality up your backside. I was in so much pain and shock that the first thing that hit my head was the beat and the bass. The bass was hard, so I just ripped off my top, wrapped it around my finger, and tied it up as tight as I could and skanked it out for half an hour. My mentality was, I've only been here an hour. I paid £10 for this night. I've lost my little finger. Am I seriously going to go? Nah, I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more. After that, my mate dragged me down to the paramedics. And the child goes onto this stripe, going down to the paramedics. He's like, can you just bandage this up so I can just rave on? He's like, nah, mate, you're down in hospital. And there's a chance of septicemia because of the dirt. So he put some medical acid on his finger. I poured it right onto the finger. And the flesh just melted right in front of the kid's eyes. And he said that was the worst pain he'd ever felt in his life.
Medical acid.
It's just acid.
I don't care if it's real. I'm sure there's many utilities for medical acid, but putting the word medical in front of something that has no legitimate purpose in your day-to-day life is always funny to me.
Yeah. Okay, so finally, the kid sort of sums up his idea. He goes, well, what can you do? There are fit girls around you, the bass is hard, the music is popping. I didn't want to be the sore thumb sticking out or the sore pinky, so I was like, fuck it, let's stand on and enjoy it. And yeah, that really creeped me out because, you know, I live in this happy little, I suppose it's like a suburban home, and you've got this crazy, crazy shit that just happens yards from your doorstep. And it's really quite comforting in its own way, you know, because for some reason the trouble stops just a little bit down the road from me. And I've got my little oasis of happiness and calm. But there's these evil, druddy zombies dancing to music I hate in places that should just be left alone apart from historical societies.
I like that part where he said that he was sober at the time, because we, you and I both know that's the universal code for I was shit blasted at the time.
Yeah. If anyone ever protests that they were sober at anything, if ever it needs to be said, you know there was enough stuff in your body to bring down some kind of African elephant.
The reason that he probably made it to the hospital at all is he was so drunk that he had lost the level of cognition to be anxious about it.
Yeah, that he was able to just not go straight into passed out shock. Because if I lost any part of my body, gosh, beyond like toenails or hair, I would be an inconsolable wreck. I'm not part of the generation that fought the Nazis, that called themselves the greatest generation. I'm me, and I don't think I'd handle that sort of stuff well at all. You know, people try to hide it in some sort of machismo. But if you lose a part of your body, you're going to freak out. I don't care who you are.
Yeah, I've had a little bit more experience with physical pain than you probably, because I've broken a fair number of limbs and had bicycle accidents that were more traumatic than you might think.
And I've avoided every single possibility that I might be put in pain throughout my entire life. I've mostly spent time sitting in comfortable rooms, reading books or watching DVDs. That has been most of my life up to this point.
Yeah, that's been a fair chunk of that's a fair chunk of every millennial's life. I'm sure there's a cutoff where anybody under 31 most of their life was putting DVDs into their laptop.
Yeah.
But no, I've experienced a fair deal of physical pain, and I've when I broke my leg, it was severely busted up, but you know, the Vicodin took care of all that. The issue I think with losing a digit, even a useless seemingly useless extremity like a small toe or whatever,
yeah,
it's a mental thing. It bugs you because it's not correctable. I think that's a bigger issue than any pain that's associated with it. It would have to be, right?
Well, it's something you've taken for granted your entire life. You think that you'd be there together. You end up mourning the connection that you used to have with that little toe. And if anything, I suppose, if I had to choose anything to do, it would be my little toe on my left-hand side. I've just chosen it here and now. But I'd still really, really miss it. I'd look down and look, you know, wistful for times that me and my little toe had spent together.
Yeah, that's my reasoning on the issue, too. It would be looking at your hand where that finger used to be. And it's, you know, it's a resistance to change more than anything. You're upset that there's yeah, been a change in the system. It doesn't matter that it doesn't matter necessarily that the change is losing a finger. You could be gaining a finger and it would still upset you.
I would be quite upset if I somehow gained a sixth finger. Well, fifth finger, really.
Well, you would assume you're in a Cronenberg movie and you would question reality at all times, so that would be no good.
What else is it, right? I think it's the fear for the future rather than what's currently going on to be the worst thing.
Yeah, I don't like the future. Modernity's bad. You know, I say that modernity's good all the time on the show. I don't believe it.
It's because you fear modernity and what it might do if it finds out that you dislike it.
The future is a war, James Murphy. Look at the papers. Look around you.
the future's got a consciousness. If it decides that you zig while it zags, it will hunt you down and eliminate you.
Well, I think my issue with the future is that it's all moving towards cities, and the places that I have lived are in a permanent state of decay.
Yeah, they'll flatten you. How is the place where you live? How's everything going down there?
You know, it's going pretty great. It's when I say great, I mean it perpetually pretty bad. But funny story about that sketch that I wrote earlier. I did it in the middle of the night, right after my brother left for work, and I was sitting down finishing up the last few lines, and my brother runs out the door, and the screen door slams behind him. 2 minutes later, I hear a slam again. Of course, you know, I'm assuming that he forgot his cigarettes or some shit, and I finish writing the sketch. Mm-hmm. The next morning, and by morning, I mean noon, I wake up, and it turns out that my truck window has been smashed in, and a good deal of my stuff has been stolen. A considerable amount of my stuff is gone.
Ah, shit. What was in there? What did you keep in there?
The truck has, for the last few years, been essentially an extension of my bedroom, because I haven't had a bedroom in quite a long time. So all of my clothes, just about, except for a couple things like that Pakistani jacket made in Abbottabad that I love so much.
Yeah. But without clothes now?
Well, I have some clothes. I got to replace a lot of stuff, though, for sure. Because the people who broke into my truck, they went through my through all my underwear and socks and stuff, and I don't want to wear underwear or socks that have been rifled through by itinerant tweakers.
Right.
No matter how many times I wash it, it's just a mental block. Maybe that's vanity. My grandma would probably tell me to get over it. Once it's run through the wash, can't be that bad. But there's some.
Well, there was that saying that became the title of an Ian Dury album, that there's only two things that you should buy new, and that's new boots and pants, underpants. So I think I can understand the logic of wanting to get soiled, druddy underwear as far away from you as possible.
When you put it that way, it makes a lot of sense. Ian Dury seems like a smart guy. That's a keen observation. Thanks, Ian.
Yeah.
But what did they get? What did they abscond with? Obviously, meth heads did it. But there's a lot of...
Maybe it's giant fucking bats, monstrous, with teeth slavering with rabies.
It's funny how much it has, my living situation now has in common with yours, because the house that I'm in is fairly nice, and we got an air conditioner and a front yard, and we're doing all right, but, you know, you walk a couple blocks in the wrong direction, and everyone is on drugs. But
you got any support for my theory that it was giant monster bats?
No, it was not monster bats. Wait. Okay. There were thumbprints. One of the neighbors got broken into, and they took thumbprints, and I don't think bats have those. Do they? I don't know. Maybe they do.
I'll look into it for us. But don't worry, what are you telling me?
Research it after the show. You can put a link in the episode description to what bats are like.
Yeah.
But what did they get away with? They got both of my blazers and most of my cash, which admittedly was not a whole lot of cash. And they got a birthday card from my grandma containing a check for a grand total of $20.
Good Lord.
Presumably. But it's funny how your outlook on this kind of thing changes with age, because I would have been inconsolable about this 5 years ago, but now...
Well, it's an invasion of your privacy, of your sacred ground there.
That still hurts, but it's not as bad as it would have once upon a time when I had more stability. I've fallen through enough safety nets since I went to college that this just doesn't affect me like it used to. And that's good, I think. I don't know if it's wisdom, but it's stoicism, and I think that's close enough.
Well, if your hands are calloused, then you won't feel the shoving quite as bad.
Exactly. That's a great comparison. That's the kind of comparison writers should do. I always try to do, it's like something. I always try to come up with something, and I never can. Because my frame of reference is so narrow. But anyway.
It's like a truck that's been broken into.
And now I have to go to the store and buy new socks and boxer shorts. Damn it. But, you know, I was just, I went out to my truck and I saw the smashed in window. And all I could think of was, there was no five stages of grief or anything like that. I just thought, this is disappointing. I'm not even grieving. This just is disappointing. It sucks, really.
What terrible shame, you thought immediately.
Yeah, I already knew that I despised meth heads because I've spent my whole life in extraordinarily close proximity to them. And my issue historically with meth heads, and I don't know if Breaking Bad gets into any details about this, but what happens to meth heads is they become the drug and are no longer people after a while.
I mean, that's true of any addiction, though, isn't it? It just takes from the person until the person ain't remaining no more.
Yeah, well, I've known some functional coke heads. You know, James Brown managed to keep doing coke and PCP until he was 73 years old.
It's different for rich guys, though. When you've got a giant support system and enough money not to have to turn to crime for your
addiction. That's true, you're right. It's an underclass thing, isn't it? Maybe it's possible to do meth and still have self as a rich person. I don't know, but I don't really want to find out either. All I know is that, in my experience, it's a disgusting drug. It's worse than any other drug that I've ever seen people on. But, I was just disappointed because the meth heads cross the psychic line where the neighborhood gets acceptable.
Right.
And I was also, that blazer, one of the blazers I had, I bought it last Christmas. It was kind of designated as my job interview blazer, and I don't really have a closet, so I had it hanging in the back so that it would be nice and job interview ready should the need arise. And I got it on clearance. I was attached to it. It fit, which never happens with jackets. Jackets are awful if you ever go shopping for them. It's impossible to shop for jackets.
I have the worst problem with trousers because I've got quite short legs, so nothing ever really fits in that way. I hate it. Jackets, yeah. I don't have a lot of trouble with.
I don't like shopping online either. I hate because if you have to return it suddenly, this is a 3-week process and it's in your head for too long.
I mean, I probably would never return anything that someone sent me online. Because people have sent me things that I couldn't afford, and it's got to me and not worked, and I've just not wanted to deal with the problem of getting to it, you know?
Yeah, but that jacket, though, it was kind of my working-class boy trying to make good jacket, and I wanted, you know, I won't be able to replace it, not for a few months anyway, and I certainly won't be able to fix my window because my insurance doesn't cover random acts of meth heads.
No, and they kind of stole your hopes and dreams there, Caleb, by taking your jacket.
Well, I don't think there were any job interviews coming down the pike real fast or anything, but I liked having it there. It was a sense of, I am ready to go to a job interview should one arise in the spur of the moment.
You know, that broom probably going to ruin that nice jacket you're wearing there, boy.
It is weird because I'm still detached from it. It was like watching a movie. I had always prepared for the eventuality that all of my shit would get stolen. I've always been ready for that. Have you?
Yeah, I guess so. I sleep with a baseball bat directly next to my head because I can't even lose that feeling that someone might just impede into my house.
Yeah, I have a crowbar.
Yeah.
My brother had a huge novelty crowbar.
If you beat a man to death with a huge novelty crowbar, I think people would be slightly amused by that.
And what is my brother, not to be outdone, my other younger brother has a giant novelty wrench, and it's very shiny. And he says, you know what, it's bigger than the novelty crowbar, so, you know, if we both get broken into, I'll have a sense of superiority. It's not the worst thing that's ever happened to me, so there was no surprise element at all. I just thought, yeah, this town is a nightmare, so it makes sense for some nightmare stuff to happen once in a blue moon. I took some solace in the lack of discriminating powers of the thieves, because they did not manage to steal my Steve Earle, The Revolution Starts Now shirt, and they didn't steal my Antone's Blues Club shirt with Little Walter on the front. And I had some money hidden in a Zippo lighter box, and they didn't find that. It was only $17, but, you know, I felt proud of myself that they were unable to find it.
Maybe they really, really dislike Steve Earle for what he said about Bob Dylan once.
You know, I don't think Steve Earle crossed into their consciousness at any point in their lives.
Maybe he bought meth from them once.
Steve Earle, he wouldn't do meth.
I'm pretty sure he did quite a lot of meth.
Yeah, I thought he was on heroin.
Right.
I guess, but he's recovered. Didn't you see him on The Wire?
Yeah, but acting really badly. He was a terrible actor.
I don't know. I never actually saw. I saw him on Treme, and he was going on and on about seeing Lucinda Williams at Tipitina's, and I just thought, oh, this is too much name dropping in one sentence. I'm kind of done with the show. Even though I love Candy Alexander, who's great in that show, but I had to lose track of it.
So these thieves in your truck, they left that $17 in your Zippo lighter case.
Yeah, they also, well, in surveying the damage, something wonderful happened because I found something that I totally forgot that I had ever had. 3 years ago, Lucinda Williams, who we mentioned earlier totally by chance, right? She gave me a set list and she autographed the back of it and wrote her cell phone number on it. And I completely forgot that I had that. I had just, I had put it in my glove box and I had forgot about it.
Have you told Lucinda Williams?
No, I have not called Lucinda Williams. I don't know what I would call Lucinda Williams about.
Lucinda, you got any batteries? I need to borrow some batteries.
That was pretty cool hanging out with you 3 years ago. What's up now? You're working on a new album? How's T-Bone Burnett doing? What's it like having millions of dollars? No, Lucinda Williams is great. I don't want to poke fun at her. She's one of my heroes. She's fantastic.
Absolutely.
But
Emmylou Harris for me.
The thieves tossed that set list on the floor, which had been in the glove box, while they were prowling for cash. And it was great because ultimately that's the only valuable thing in there. It's the only thing that's not quite replaceable. It's the only sentimental thing that was in that truck, really, except I'm pissed about the jacket because I won't have one, but I can go get one someday, theoretically.
Yeah.
And now it's that set list is kind of a monument to survival a little bit. It's the thing that escaped the great purge of the contents of my truck in 2014, so I'm even more fond of it.
Wayfaring Stranger by Emmylou Harris. That's one of my favorite songs.
Emmylou Harris is an angel. I remember at Thanksgiving one year, this was back when my family still was very... I don't know why they were close. It didn't make sense then, but my family was close once upon a time, and we had all gotten together in Bakersfield and we were for Thanksgiving dinner, and somebody in the family, I don't remember who, I think it was one of my aunts, she got really pissed off that my grandpa was watching something with Emmylou Harris, and he said she was pretty, and my aunt started insisting that Emmylou Harris has had far too much plastic surgery, at which point my grandfather says, no, Lucinda Williams is an angel, essentially. And my uncle starts loudly and in a very stagey manner insisting that Emmylou Harris is an angel and that her face is so perfect from birth that it would never need plastic surgery to touch it. She is beyond those sorts of earthly criteria. Angels don't get plastic surgery.
They yelled
for a while, and then my uncle demanded that we put on the Emmylou Harris album Wrecking Ball. And yeah. So we all had to sit around at Thanksgiving dinner while Wrecking Ball played too loud for us to hear each other talk, and he folded his arms, and he was just pissed.
It's not a happy record either.
No, it's not a happy record. That is not a good record to have on playing on Thanksgiving.
Just this down south melancholy rattling in the windows.
It is a great, great record, though. I really, despite Daniel Lanois being involved, it's... Where Will I Be is pretty amazing.
If you keep Lanois in his place, you know, if you don't let him overwhelm things with his kind of overly sentimental mistiness that he adds to everything, he's got one mood. He's like Michael Bay, actually. You know, if you keep him back, you can get something that's listenable about if the talent involved is good enough.
Right, and Daniel Lanois is always treading this line where his aesthetic is overwhelming the performer a little bit. But he was responsible for one of the best Bob Dylan albums and one of the best Emmylou albums. I just wish he'd toned down that it's foggy by the ocean kind of shittiness.
Well, it comes back to Bill Street, doesn't it, really?
Does it?
I think so. I think he tries to take that 3 a.m. in New Orleans feel.
I guess he does, but it feels so artificial when he does it. It feels like if it's effects pedals trying to replicate a sensation that is too earthy to be done by effects pedals, almost.
What else was in your truck?
Just, you know, everything that's ever mattered to me. But luckily, they didn't get to anything in the back. And I started when I was emptying out the truck to, you know, because I got to remove the glass from it so that other people may one day sit in it.
Yeah.
I started getting, this is why it was kind of fun, ultimately. It was exhausting. I'm still exhausted from all this because all the neighbors got broken into also, so we've been dealing with that. But I, every time I found something that I assumed they would have stolen, but they did not steal, I got overjoyed. I became a giddy 9-year-old. Because, for example, they didn't get my sunglasses. I found a perfect pair of sunglasses 4 years ago, and they were on sale, so I bought 5 pairs of them. And I've burned through 3. So I have a pair now, and then I have my backup pair for one of these days. And they didn't get my backup pair, so I'm still good on sunglasses, hopefully for the rest of my life.
There's something of the doomsday prepper about you, Caleb Horton.
Well, I'm prepping for absolutely an economic doomsday, because I've done enough of basically living in my car and sleeping in movie theater parking lots. So, you know, I'm always ready for the money to dry up and never again go anywhere near myself.
Right.
But I'm not attached to things. So I'm very fortunate.
Yeah, I realized that when I was moving. It was a lot of, none of this matters at all. I can just, you know, clothes and wardrobe. That's all I need. I want lots and lots of books. That's my only thing I get attached to is my books. And even then I got here and my partner was like, well, 75% of these need to go because I'm not living in a house that's just books.
I can get behind that a little bit. It depends. I don't know. How many books do you have?
I got it down to the minimum 300 before I came down here, and then she looked at the amount of it, and she says, do you know how small this flat is? It's not going to work out. And then she offered me to do a one-in, one-out policy, so if I buy a new book, I have to throw an old one away, and I put my foot down there. But there's a lot sitting in an airing cupboard now that will probably just rot.
I can see both sides of this. I don't want to ever be accused of saying that 300 books is too many books, but in terms of space, that might be too many.
Yeah.
Maybe. It might be, because I've known people who are essentially hoarders and the books become part of the landscape of the house and you have to navigate around them. And it's at that point where you go, okay, maybe give these to Goodwill. Maybe.
I mean, playing devil's advocate as well, how many of those am I realistically ever going to read front to back again? I can see the other side of it as well.
Well, I have virtually every book that I'm very attached to I have for the Kindle program. On the computer, so physical. I love to not need physical space. I love MP3s, and I it would be cool to have enough money to be attached to the physical nature of a book or an album or whatever. And I totally understand those kind of analog fetishists who are essentially the same group of people, whether it's for records or for books. But that's not me, luckily.
I mean, I feel like. Without the physical object, sometimes you value the artifact less, like the media, whatever you're consuming. So I don't think I've ever connected with music in quite the same way since I've stopped paying for CDs. I think it's been something I can take or leave. Whereas the stuff that I've got on CD is things that I know I'll return to forever. But that also might be because I listened to that stuff when I was 16 years old, and everyone knows that's when music hits you the hardest anyway.
Right, it's tough to say. I know that when I mostly was acquiring music by way of my grandfather's record collection, that I was very, very into albums as such. And I love, you know, I always felt like an album told a story about a particular moment in time, and there was kind of an arc to an album, and there were a lot of different things to enjoy. Yeah. And I will always, I think, on some level, prefer MP3 to any kind of physical media because that it suits my lonesome wandering hobo lifestyle a little bit.
Yeah, you could be a long bearded hobo eating beans out of a can on the back of an anachronistic boxcar train, and you could be listening to the Sonics bootleg from 2007 Reunion.
Wow, how did you know I have that?
I've known you a while.
Wow, I must have sent that to you a long time ago or something. Who knows?
Yeah, you did.
I love the Sonics. Those guys kick ass. Have you ever heard Psycho? What a song, man.
They suck it.
But no, in the MP3, because this again, the gray area comes up where I wonder if this is just me getting older. But in the MP3 age, Most bands, I get the single and I'm done. I bounce.
Yeah, last, I can definitely get behind that. The last group that I listened to their album, I thought, wow, I'll listen to that again, was probably Fiddler. I think that was 2013.
Every year there's a couple of albums where I'm interested in every song telling a story on it, but it's got to be very spectacular and very much within my niche. The only one that's met that criteria this year is the new Roseanne Cash album.
Right. And but, that's so within your wheelhouse.
I know. It's absurd how within my wheelhouse it is. I'm going to see her in October, so I'm thrilled about that.
Yeah, I mean, live music's a different thing. Have you been to any live shows lately?
I did, actually, but we'll get back to that. What I want to... I was thinking about the meth heads from earlier. The thing that bugged me is that I wished I could have reasoned with them, because I said, look... This is what I was thinking. I thought, look, I'm completely itinerant. The things that you're stealing are not things I can reasonably expect to replace. Things you're breaking, I cannot fix them. Go steal from Walmart. You know, I wanted to just tell them, go steal from Walmart. It's so easy. Nobody will be angry at you except Walmart security. Have you ever seen an employee at Walmart? They're too tired to deal with you. As long as you get out, it's cool. Don't steal from others.
Fast.
Don't steal from other people who are at the bottom of the same ladder as you.
It happens in riots and shit all the time. You never see them going up the... I mean, I think this is a Bill Hicks bit, so I'm sorry if I'm stealing this subconsciously. But I had the thought during the London riots that they were just smashing up their own houses and the houses of the people who live near them. It's like the rich people live slightly up the way. Don't smash their house.
It's not a long drive. You could walk there. You could walk to the Walmart. But no, I had a friend who, whenever we went to the grocery store when I was living on my own, he always had this big oversized hobo jacket, and he would go steal a couple of bottles of booze while I was doing my legitimate shopping, and then I would always go, "That's shitty of you," but I never cared in the same way where I wanted to give him a long-winded lecture about class war. It was reassuring to know every car on my block got broken into, because you hear how it takes tragedy to bring people together, that old cliche, but I didn't know any of my neighbors at all, and now I know all of them by their first name, except the cop whose car was broken into also. I didn't. I still haven't run across that guy ever. I still have this... I'm never going to be cool with cops.
Yeah, I was listening to a punk song about a good cop. It's the Dropkick Murphys from Boston.
And their song Boston, we all know I love Boston.
Loving Boston strong. And the song's John Law, and it's like, he's a good cop, we like John Law. And I thought, what would be great is if the chord structure to this would be A, C, A, B. Wouldn't that be a clever thing to do? But they're not smart enough to do that.
Would that work for the song contextually? Did you try playing ACAB with it? Then
I tried. It's not the chords, but if you were to write a seemingly, ostensibly pro-police song and have the chords quietly going, "All toppers are bastards," that'd be great.
It's a very whimsical idea. You should make an album of these whimsical ideas.
James Murphy's music that no one wants to hear.
Oh man, every time I sit down and try to record something, it starts off as basically Delta Blues and then meanders right into atonal for an hour and a half.
Just the bottom two notes on the 13th string.
But now the great thing about all my neighbors on the block also getting broken into is that it removes your any concept of specialness that you had going into the situation. You have a little bit of solidarity, and you're not special in your victimhood necessarily, so that makes it easier to deal, I think.
Yeah, you feel less victimized. You feel like nothing that you've done has drawn them in. It's just a complete spree.
Right, and I heard there were people who told me that my car was an advertisement to be broken into because there was stuff in it, and I was thinking, oh, I guess they were right for a few seconds, and then no, it turned out that there were cars with nothing in them that were also broken into.
Yeah.
But there was a vigilante streak that has been arising in everyone in the days following the event, because everybody has been asking everybody else if they saw which meth heads did it, because there's a lot of meth heads, so everyone's kind of keeping their eyes peeled, you know. And whoever they are, $100 says they live two or three blocks away. Realistically. Sure. So everyone is a suspect if there's any signs of meth disrepair. If their yard is slightly unkempt or if they have a car over 20 years old in the driveway, that's enough, really, for people to be suspicious.
You like the Twilight Zone, don't you?
I love the Twilight Zone.
I'm thinking of that one, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. I think that's what you're living through now.
Which one is that?
That's the one where I think that all their lights go out except one house, and then they all start turning on each other.
Oh, what a great show. I don't know if I've seen that. It's probably been too long, but oh, I love that show. Yeah. I don't want to wax nostalgic about how many hours on New Year's Eve over the years I've spent watching The Twilight Zone in the dark. Nobody needs
Man,
to know that part
the
of
Twilight
my life.
When this is finished.
But at one point, after the fact, somebody came up to our door and they accused my brother of being part of the meth gang. But he was trying to be jokey. He was trying to be working class badass about it. And the guy goes, "This kid has a busted up car, and he left at exactly the same time my car got broken into." And the guy, this is what he actually said. He said, "The kid's lucky I was in my boxer shorts and didn't have my shotgun handy because his car was fucked up and the timeline fit."
Jesus.
And I was upset, but I was upset, but I understand his paranoia.
Yeah, no, well, you know that it is someone nearby because it doesn't make any sense for a criminal to hit somewhere far away if they've only got, you know, either their vehicle, which doesn't make any sense, or they're just doing it bodily. If you don't carry the shit too far back to your hideout.
Right, they were on foot. They were obviously on foot because they left behind things that they had suddenly decided were not of value in a field. But I was upset, but I understood where the guy was coming from, because if I thought that I had my guy, if I thought I had the suspect, then don't you think, you know, I would also pursue it with equal fervor, I think, if I was as sure as that guy was.
Yeah, you
but I don't. I think his evidence was too circumstantial also, because, you know, it's kind of upsetting that he thought my brother's car being fucked up was enough cause to think that he was addicted to meth. The reason my brother's car is in a state of disrepair is because he got in a wreck and couldn't afford to fix the, you know, cosmetic damage.
I mean, that's the shit about vigilante justice, is it's all kangaroo courts, and that means not circumstantial evidence is always going to be king. And I don't, you know, ascribe to a lot of laws that people have just made up and decided were right, but I think a fair trial is a pretty helpful thing. It stops people swinging from lampposts.
Well, but at the same time, it makes sense that he was wanting to enact vigilante justice, because, you know, not even the cop was messing with figuring out who busted into his car. It was meth heads. You're never going to find him. So no. The law's not getting involved either. It's vigilante justice or nothing.
It helps to put it under, like, the banner of meth heads, because that immediately dehumanizes them. It turns them into, like, scurrying rats with powder up their nose for you, you know?
You know, I thought about that.
But, I mean, for the neighborhood in general.
I was going to say, I thought about that, but it was exactly the way all meth-related crimes in town work. Those kind of sprees that are sort of without rhyme or reason, that are uncoordinated. You know, it's typically method. You know, I don't imagine a drunk guy going and smashing, you know, how many cars? I guess it was about 8 cars. There's also been other thefts in our neighborhood that only meth heads commit, such as the theft of copper wire and so forth.
Yeah.
So it's a conclusion I didn't arrive at lightly, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now the mood of the neighborhood is something a bit worse than a hostel, which I, you know, is fun because it's better than nothing in a way, in terms of you can look at your house and something's going on. Usually there's nothing going on. And it took this crime to unify us in our misery and our judgmental impulses. But it's just, on some basic human level, it's good to see something bringing these people from different walks of life who would never talk to each other into a common ground of hating people who are addicted to meth. That's enough of an icebreaker.
If I remember right, the people in Arthur Miller's The Crucible, the people in that town were quite happy.
I don't know anything about Arthur Miller or The Crucible. I mostly read about hobos, you know me. Are there any hobos in that Arthur Miller thing?
Not as far as I remember.
Yeah, see, so it's useless to me.
I have a copy of the Death of a Salesman.
I've been reading mostly biographies of dead actors lately, but not just Robert Mitchum, but a whole bunch of people. But my big hang up with books is that if something gets this is I've gotten too committed to the loner thing, because if something enters the zeitgeist again for so much as a second, I start to question the book immediately, because I have a copy of The Great Gatsby and I'd been continually meaning to get to it. And then that movie came out with Leonardo DiCaprio, or I don't know who was in it, but that movie, yeah. The Great Gatsby in 3D.
It just looked like a pee into overindulgence, really. That book's like 90 pages long. How have you put it off for so long?
Because it just didn't seem interesting at all looking at the back cover. That's the only reason. I would rather read about the Dust Bowl. Like, I'm very, very specific. And as I get older, I'm getting more specific about the things that I know I'm going to enjoy. I want to know going into the book that it's up my alley, which is a weakness of mine, and I know that.
I mean, The Great Gatsby is about the same length, take about the same time to read as Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. You definitely prefer that.
Yeah, but never mind my mediocrity in the intellectual sphere. But later that day, after the big break, and I had a cinematic moment where I felt totally honest and completely divorced from ego and affectation, and it was sort of a great moment. I had to drive my truck to get groceries and gas, and you know, there was glass all in the passenger side and everything, but my seat was fine. In the end, they didn't steal the engine, and I, you know, it feels like a victory for them if I don't go get the groceries like I'd already intended to. You know, I can't let them defeat me mentally like that. But I had to drive my truck and get groceries and gas just for my own sense of sanity, you know. Yeah. And I was listening to Bobby Womack's California Dreaming as I was driving to the gas station, because that's just always in my CD player. Not because I was trying to spin some ego narrative, some woe is me shit. But but the song's playing, and it didn't occur to me as I got into the car that once the glass is broken into, it has no structural integrity. So as the song is playing, the glass is raining down from my shattered windows, and it sounds for all the world like a rain stick. And there was something oddly musical about the ruin that was going on, and it complimented Bobby Womack pretty well, I think. But I just felt completely divorced from anxiety in that moment, where I realized, you know, this is cinematically speaking, this has to be the low point in the movie, because there's glass raining down from my ruined window, and I'm going to go get enough gas to get to the grocery store. I'm going to get $3 in gas. Like, everything is ruined at this moment in time.
Your bright, clear, shining baptism of glass has purified you for the rest of your journey, your hero's journey.
Right. But, you know, I just thought, if this is as bad as it gets, you know, that's fine. I'm not in any pain. It's okay. And I got to the gas station, and there was a huge swastika spray painted on the wall, and I just went, okay, I'm done. There's no more lying. There's no more pretension. And if you had asked me any question at that moment, where I got out of my truck and I slammed the door and I heard more glass shatter on the inside of the truck, if you had asked me any question at that moment while I'm staring at that swastika, I would have had no affect at all. I would have just been as pure as a child. I mean, it felt oddly great. It's just everything is terrible, and we can all just agree on this, and the playing field is now level in my environment.
It sounds like the perfect moment for you to quit some kind of an addiction you don't actually have.
Yeah, and the narrative will say that that's where I quit drinking.
Yeah.
But, There was good news, though. Some neighbors found my birthday card with the check intact in a drainage ditch a day later. And the gang who done busted into my car, they had tried to burn it, but they only singed the edges. So life goes on.
Nothing can burn a symbol of love. I'll tell you what your grandma should have done, which is lie about the amount of money that they'd sent.
No, they're very, very consistent about the amount of money. But now, what else happened? Oh, you know what? I went to go see Dave and Phil Alvin. The guys done did that song that is our theme song.
How were they?
That's happier. They're always fantastic. They're my boys. Those are the best.
And they kind of gave us permission to use their song "Rock and Roll Will Stand" as our theme music.
Yeah, and they don't tour together terribly often, so it was a very rare thing to see them both together on a stage like that. They did a bunch of Big Bill Brunzi songs, and they did Phil Alvin did this great version, and nobody cares, but he did a version of "If I Had My Way, I'd Tear This Building Down" that was very, very Great Depression-y, which I have a lot of respect for. And they're both on the same wavelength about the other California, the working class. So I'll always rep for them and try to go see them when I can. But the drive down to the venue was fantastic. I've never made this drive before. It was about 50 miles out of town, maybe a little bit more. Not that anybody gives one single shit, but the drive is this bizarre alternate reality at the very north of Highway 99, which used to be the big thoroughfare in California before it was usurped by the Interstate 5, not that you care. And
no, I understand. I've actually got a grounding and understanding of the American highway system, which I quite like.
That would be helpful for you if you ever decided to become an expat and move out here.
I know that the smaller highways were completely superseded when the big ones came through, and that for a long time in the 50s, people just didn't have roads from one community to another, so you're just born in a place and you had to stay there.
Yeah, pretty much. And this stretch of Highway 99 from where I live down to where the concert was so idyllic in the day that it was almost painful because there were no chain anything. It was all individual stores that were obviously made by people. There was no, contractors involved. It was a person giving money to someone else to build one building like this.
What?
And all the grocery stores were called things like grocery. And there was a store that just was called meat. It was just this old neon sign that said meat. And there was a roadside bar. I'd forgotten that roadside bars existed. I just used those as a narrative device in stories about old shit.
I think it's a bad idea. It is very cool.
Roadside bar is a bad idea?
Yeah, definitely. Because, well, we do want to disencourage drink driving.
Well, I don't know if having two beers and detoxing from a very long drive down an empty stretch of highway is a problem, but I can see, I see where it could be. I don't know. I've never been to a roadside bar. I've just seen them.
I just imagine people just shotgunning whiskey and then getting back.
Yeah, that's what you imagine, don't you? But I'm sure it's a lot of old people coming in for one beer.
Yeah, and then probably. It's probably the safest place in the world.
Every once in a while, some wayward alcoholic who doesn't have a car. But, I don't know if the numbers are, so I'm not going to pretend I'm qualified to comment. But anyway, it was all small boutique businesses that had no connection to 2014 at all. It was 1974 out here, and that was just really beautiful. There was a place that had it just said chocolate shop, and there was a sign with a rooster that said open on it, and it was just wonderful. And everything was in bloom. There were lots of crops and everything, and it was just completely delightful. But on the way back, in the dark, it takes on a completely different tone. Because
what's it like?
There was in the dark, you notice different things based on what's lit up. And you start to get paranoid, too, because there's no other cars on the road. So if you see one other pair of headlights, you get paranoid.
What's the other car up to?
Yeah, or if you see a helicopter, you just assume it's a UFO because you're so unused to seeing a flying object at all. So all of them are unidentified. And that's where,
It has to be after you, if it is a helicopter, if you think of it in that term, because why else would it be out there? Who could it be for?
But it's when you're driving through an empty road like this at night that's been disregarded by the bigger highway, then you start to understand why so many rural people are involved in documentaries about the paranormal or about aliens, because in the fog, something ambiguous takes on a dark image to you, And sure. your imagination can run away with you very easily. I remember I was driving with my grandpa once. We were going to a mechanic, and he saw a car on the side of the road with a foot dangling out of it, and even as stoic as he was, he freaked out for a second because he assumed there was just a regular dead body in that trunk, but it was, you know, like a Halloween prop or something.
What?
But on the way back, I found everything was weird and desolate after about 11 at night. Everything that was so Andy Griffith during working hours became, you know, you started to think, I need to be in a house right now with locks on the doors, deadbolt everything.
That pig out of Green Acres is suddenly a Nazi.
Exactly. And there was so little lighting that when you saw lighting, it stood out as being strange. And you thought, why are they lighting this when no one else is lighting anything? So what was lit up? There was a Baptist church with an oversized cross that was way far away from the main thoroughfare. So you're driving and there's no light, but the only light is this Baptist church with a cross that is past a bunch of field and a bunch of trees. And then there was something. This was great. I don't want to sound condescending about it, but there was a building that said Cowboy Church, and so it was a guy on a horse in a cowboy hat, and there was a cross somewhere. But on the fence, there was a wood thing that just said religion. So he's jumping a fence that just says religion, and the imagery was very strange and a bit labored, and I just thought it was hysterical.
Yeah.
And there was a building that just said fabrication on it. I assume fabrication has something to do with metal. I wouldn't actually know. I could pretend I do, but I'm not going to.
Textiles or something, maybe.
Right, and it was just lit up very green, and I thought, nah, this seems like the perfect place to die. Oh, and you know what else? There was a strip club 30 miles away from anything. There was a strip club, and next to it was, you know, something extremely working class. It was something involving metal or paint or something.
Darlene, the loneliest stripper in the world.
And it was so disconnected from society that it seems like the place where Randy Quaid kills you in a neo-noir. It just, you couldn't... Whatever I thought rock bottom was, that became the representation for a new rock bottom altogether.
Just before you died, you watched the lights that spelt out fabrication flicker and die in that neon way.
So naturally, I took pictures of all this stuff because I just had to. I had to take my time and do it. Why the hell not?
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, Twitter for the week. Wow, we synced up. That's modernity working right there.
It sure is.
What'd you get up to?
On Twitter for you?
I don't know. I don't know what I got up to. A whole lot of nothing.
We synced up again, man. This is some Mary Poppins shit.
Jinx, you owe me a soda. I don't know. All that World Cup commentary from Americans. I don't want this to ever make the mistake of talking about sports because neither of us, it's way out of the depth of both of us.
I try to care about it, and the World Cup's supposed to be a place where we can jump on, you know, people who don't give a shit, but I don't give a fuck at all. There was a man who bit another man. Yeah. That was pretty good. That was interesting.
I love reading about salary disputes and things like that. That's where I start to get interested in sports, is the money and the owners.
Well, yeah, it's a horrifically ostentatious, massive amount of money that's involved with it.
Well, I also have respect for athletes a little bit because it seems like the only way to break out of a very unfortunate life situation. That's the one thing you're good at and you're making a crack at it, you know, and you get paid exorbitantly. It's the same impulse that I have behind writing. It's just the one thing I know how to do that could bust me out of working retail for my entire life.
I always used to say that it was like two escapes from working class drudgery, and that was crime and sport. And eventually they added pop music to it, but that's now closed off to it.
Music is closed off to it because of the upfront investment. Nobody wants to hear somebody with an acoustic guitar. That's not going to happen.
No.
but no, all this World Cup commentary from Americans specifically makes me want to do something just insanely American, like buy a motorcycle and ride to Wyoming. Because it seems so it's so labored. It's such an affectation for Americans to pretend they care about Europe. I don't know. I'm just going to say soccer.
Soccer's fine.
But it, it, It seems like Americans trying desperately to relate to cosmopolitan English people and to be citizens of the world when they're not. You live in LA or San Francisco, you're no citizen of the world just because you have a couple of British friends, right?
I like the ponies. I watch a horse race or a dog race. That seems like a pretty fair way to go about things. But any other sport, when it's people involved, it's just dumb.
Yeah, I'm just getting more and more frustrated with it because it seems like a statement of you're putting on a persona a little bit almost, because Americans are not conditioned to care about soccer. So where are you picking this up from? Where does this impulse start?
I must imagine it comes from like Spanish Twitter feeds, because you know, somewhere like Spain, and soccer is the biggest deal in the world. Brazil, especially, I'm glad they got the cup, the World Cup, to sit there, because the poor people of Brazil have only like really, really rich people to look at down their hill and playing football in the street. So it's quite nice that they've got that to have going on around them. So I think that must be all it is. America wanting to fit in with the people that they see as more sophisticated.
I suppose. I think it's pretentious.
Yeah, and wrongly perceive others as more sophisticated.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that I have any issue with European soccer. Go for it if you're European. I totally get why people enjoy sports and everything. It would be awesome to want to care, you know. It would be awesome to naturally care about soccer, I think, because there's, you know. You get to be part of a group. You have a sense of belonging all of a sudden. And you get to worry about...
My friends will talk about football, and it's very much the time where I have to go, like, well, I guess I'll go over to the bar now or stare at my thumbs for 15 minutes.
Yeah, I would never unfollow on Twitter somebody European for talking about soccer. That's A-okay by me. It's only Americans that I have any kind of an issue with. Did you do anything on the social media? I don't remember anything cool happening. Social media can go screw... Can it?
You know how I'm very much into the works of Shane McGowan, and very hungry for any new examples of his brain not having completely atrophied. Well, he recently got a new piece of work out there, and it's going to hear probably the most, more people are going to hear his words now than ever before in the man's creative life, because... He wrote the lyrics to a song. He didn't do the music. The lyrics to a song for the DreamWorks film, How to Train Your Dragon 2. And it's a song that two Saxons sing to each other about love. And it's beautiful. It's really, really beautiful. But it's sung in that kind of Pixar send-up kind of way.
Ah.
And the musicians don't know how to play that type of music. So it's they do it like... Disneyland version of a jig breaking down at the end, and instead of using a tin whistle, they have someone whistling.
Oh, geez.
It's kind of hilarious how wrong they got it. But I'm always very happy to see the fact. I mean, maybe it's a song from 25 years ago that he didn't think was good enough at the time, but it's always good to see something new from him. But what I thought was, I entirely support him doing all his writing in unexpected places, so he could do lyrics for a CGI kids film, which he has, and theoretically he could do the music that he intended to go with that and put it on a fucking airport elevator or something, and that could leave the audience to match one to the other. And instead of writing a whole song, which is ridiculously cliche and spoon feeding the audience his work,
sure,
they can go on an insane scavenger hunt for it.
How many people would ride on an experiment like that? Maybe a couple of dozen, including you.
It'd be me. It'd be mostly me spearheading the thing, but I would really go for it.
I'm one of the biggest Pogues fans under the age of 40, and even I would probably bail after a couple hours.
I got drunk in my flat for the first time on Saturday, and I went down a pub and I had a couple of drinks with some friends, and my partner came out with me, and then I drank a bottle of wine, a couple of bottles of wine, and then I finished the vodka, and...
Mixing wine and vodka? Ugh.
She told me showed me a couple of reports the next day. She said, you asked if I wanted any more wine. And I was like, you've drank all the wine. And then you smashed a glass in the kitchen and went to bed. She says to me, you broke a glass. Kind of nudging me as I'm lying there in the bed. I'm like, I know. And I turned over, pulled the cover over my shoulder. And she told me to go and clean up. And got up and I did it at my bare feet, really begrudgingly. I've got a very dim memory of being in the kitchen and feeling pissed off that I had to do this. And so that was my first time I got drunk in my new flat.
Yeah, I remember one of the first times I went on a big rampaging drunk, which I'll never do again. But I staggered into some bushes and started singing Danny Boy because I was unable to get up. I guess in my subconscious, my brain associated powerlessness with singing Danny Boy to yourself.
Yeah, that's a kind of political statement, I suppose.
Yeah, but anyway, so we can go ahead and close on something. This was a downer for an episode. I guess I'm still recovering a little bit from that, from them damn tweakers done busted in my truck, Tim Murphy.
I honestly don't think it's any less of a downer than anything else we do.
Yeah, whatever. But so there's a show, Cosmos, or maybe it's Cosmo. Maybe it's Cosmos, maybe it's Cosmo. Who gives a shit is the point I'm trying to say here. And it stars this guy, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and the whole internet is obsessed with it because he says things like, space is awesome. And they say, well, scientists said it, so it's got to be fucking true. True as hell. But it's just very, very entry-level populist promotion of science, basically. And the culture around it is obnoxious. So I wrote my own take on Cosmos. I just thought it would be fun to have a version of Cosmos that's taught by, or that's narrated by somebody like me, who is essentially burned out on this new I fucking love science wave of teenagers, and somebody who's just deliberately opposed to all that. So I wrote the first page of a hypothetical pilot for a reaction show to Cosmos, and I call it Space Who Cares. And so I'm just going to read it. Interior, fake observatory. Narrator, space, who cares? You're not going there. The moon doesn't have any resources to plunder. Mars looks like Arizona. Just drive to Arizona. Hold your breath. It's the same shit. The narrator continues over a slideshow of CGI renders of space, but with no sense of scale, because we tell the artist it should be flashy. Narrator. And another thing, if space was actually cool, we wouldn't have to use so much made-up shit to write interesting space movies. And then more CGI renders and some oversaturated Hubble composites as we cut from the fake observatory to a fake library. Narrator. I sit down with a scientist to talk about this issue. Scientist. I'm a biologist, but whatever. Narrator. Why go to space, right? It's stupid. Who cares? Why'd anyone spend money on that shit? Scientist. Ha, yeah. Narrator. You're from Arizona. It sucks, right? Scientist says yes. The end.
So thanks so much for listening to the last Exit Show. If you want to support us in this endeavor, why not go to PayPal? Because we're really close to reaching our Libsyn target, and we've been so bowled over by the generosity and kindness of our audience, and so we're just going to beg a little bit more indulgence so we can really enter phase 3 of the show, build it, and get us up to a place where more people will be able to hear us. You know, people deserve to hear us. So if you want to do that, then drop a couple of pennies, dollars, pounds, euros, pieces of eight into the PayPal account, which is thelastexitshow@gmail.com.
Oh, and the number is $65. We get $65, we can make the move. But if we don't get it in a couple of weeks, I think I'm just going to call it a day on that and commit to Podomatic again. Because if we don't get it pretty soon, I'll just assume we're probably not going to, which is fine.
Nah, that's absolutely fine. It's amazing that we got as much as we have, and I want to thank everyone who's felt like they were able to.
Oh, and remember, selfishly, for anybody who wants to contribute to moving to Libsyn, if we do get the money, you will have the whole quality archive of the show. Well, if we get a Podomatic Pro subscription, we'll be able to have a bigger backlog, but we won't be putting up an archive. If we move to Libsyn, there's going to be an archive.
Back probably to when the episodes started to become listenable, really.
Yeah, the first episodes where we got pop screens. But anyway, I got a roll.
All the best. I want to thank everyone who came to see me being tortured in a dungeon in the Czech Republic. We really raised the roof, and you're a great audience. You can follow me on Twitter @_JamesMurphy. If you want to follow Caleb Horton, the man who makes all this possible, he's @CalebHorton. That's KalebHorton. The other day I knew I was in an ungenerous and tired mood getting off a train, and I saw a guy in a suit on his laptop. I thought to myself, one XL cunt. I'll see you next week.
All the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. I went for a walk on a winter's day. I'd be safe and warm if I was in your arms. California dreaming on such a winter's day, yeah. I went to a church yesterday, I stopped along the way. Well, I got down on my business and I began to pray. You know, preacher took the call, because I'm gonna stay, because I'm gonna stay. I told him so. California dreaming, yeah. Hey, somebody help me now. I wanna go so bad. Oh, all the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. For a walk on a winter's day, I'd be safe and warm if I was laying in your arms, baby. California dreaming, yeah, yeah. All right, Allison. California dreaming, got to get some sunshine. I've got to get some sunshine. Everybody need it, got to get some sunshine. Bring it down for me. I wonder would y'all mind if I played my guitar for about 5 minutes. Can I do that for you? Testing, 1, 2, 3. Bring it down real easy. Real easy, fellas. Come here, John. Now, don't be afraid, John. Come here. What happened to your guitar, John? No sound. I don't hear no sound.
No, I'm playing it.
You say what? Get over here.
I'm playing it.
You're playing it?
Yeah, I'm playing it.
All right. Now, you know what you told me in the dressing room the other day? That you was ready to take me on. Well, I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna give you about 3 minutes. And if you don't get your point across, forget it. One more minute, John. Ladies and gentlemen, I think John has had it. Would you give him a nice round of applause? Go back, John. Go back, John. It's all over, John.
Everybody feel good. Everybody feel good. Everybody feel good. Go on and feel good. Bring it on up for me. California dreaming. Dreaming. Hey, hey, hey. California dreaming. Thank you.
Thank you.